neutral party regardless, but they were very receptive to how I wanted the interview to go down, and they respected it, and it was kind of nice just to be on the same level of respect and just try to put the positivity out there, and so that was definitely a good positive.
For me, it's two stories, really. One is one that was published by the Union Tribune that directly answered one of the questions I get asked or attacked with all the time. Why didn't I just become a U.S. citizen? Why didn't you just get in line? Why is it fair for you to get in, to cut this line, right? And so this piece that Kate Morrissey from the Union Tribune did was directly answering why there's no path to citizenship for me. And so that article actually now is used in the movement to just copy and paste that article to whenever we see a troll or whenever somebody questions online, you know, why don't you just become a citizen? And then I just copy-paste that article, and here's the answer. So it has become, it's my favorite because it's become a tool. It's not just reporting, but it's actually something that I can actually use to advance on narrative. So that has been the most useful, and therefore my favorite. But the other one is with Democracy Now, because they allowed me to just blog, you know, just talk without so much restriction, which allowed me to open up for the first time, I believe, on camera in a way that I hadn't before. And that just kind of led me to do the remaining dozens of interviews after that one to open up more and more every time. So that was like the Democracy Now! Interview was the interview when I could hear myself growing and learning from that interview itself to know and learn that it's okay to be vulnerable at times when telling my story, because for them, as an undocumented person, being in the shadows for so long, I had this wall, and I think that interview with Democracy Now! Kind of brought that wall down, and I felt in a safe, comfortable space where I would actually, for the first time, open up that way.
Mm-hmm. For the Kate Morrissey story, was that your idea, or did she come to you?
This was actually before the rescission of DACA, and it's there was also a panelist in Daily Interview who were organized last August before that, I believe, the August right before the DACA rescission. This was months before that, and there were already talks about Trump, you know, possibly rescinding the program, which I couldn't believe would ever happen. And so she was asking around because she knew that one of her readers had asked that question as a comment to something else she had posted. And so she was asking the immigrant community, and as an immigration lawyer, the email was forwarded to me, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm an immigration lawyer, and I'm a DACA recipient. Let me tell you what I cannot get in line and why I cannot just adjust my status as quickly as people think that it is. And so it was kind of, in part, just networking with other attorneys that somehow, you know, she came. We found each other, I guess, somehow.
Okay. So I experience a lot of good journalism. I interact with a lot of great reporters. I think, for the most part, San Diego journalists do really good work. It's important work, and I just hope you all keep doing it. So thank you. Recently, I guess, the example that comes to mind is a client that we took on. They had a large, controversial land use project that was not the best plan, shall we say, a couple of years ago, and the voters overwhelmingly rejected it. And
don't be shy, it's a stadium.
Pardon me?
It's a stadium project. Don't be shy.
No. This is Lilac Hills Ranch.
Oh, okay.
And so we started working with them on it's a new team, a new development team, put a new plan together, and very different plan than the one that voters rejected. So not an easy story to tell, because is it the same plan? No, it's not the same plan. And here's how it's not the same plan. Is the process the same? No, it's a completely different process. They're going through the county planning process this time, where before it was ballot box planning. So we just rolled that out, what, 2 weeks ago, not even, and very good coverage of Objective Fair. Was very really pleased with the coverage that it received from all the outlets.
Okay, so then moving to maybe some stories that got things wrong this year. Taylor, you mentioned that there were some facts that were maybe wrong in a couple stories about you. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd say overall the story was focused on all the right things, but some of the smaller facts that they didn't dig into and just kind of made up, essentially. One, I was either girlfriend or married in a lot of my interviews. I was attending the festival with a girl at the time. We weren't dating or anything, but it turned into a love story, and it was fine because we didn't reject it because we knew anyone watching would relate to it better, so we just rolled with it. It's just a better story. Like, how are you going to say, oh, you know, some guy...
You weren't even dating her?
Yeah.
Really?
Not at the time.
Don't let the truth
get away. Well, she's got a boyfriend, I got a girlfriend now. So at the time, we were just there hanging out. We'd been hanging out for a while, but nothing, we weren't actually dating, but the news totally said we were, and then it turned into we were married, and that was one thing definitely wrong. Another one discrepancy would have been two tours to Iraq. I did one tour in Iraq, and then I did a tour on USS Boxer naval ship, and so that was completely turned into just two tours to Iraq, which is fine and all, but it just made me sound more heroic as a Marine than I needed to be given credit for. But end of the day, that wasn't the main focus on the story, so never really complained or said anything to anyone.
So when you saw those, you didn't reach out or try and correct the record or anything?
The main story is focused on what happened in Vegas, and they got most of the details correct, so felt no need or any reason to call them out on it.
And do you have an idea of how it happened, like how those mistakes were made?
Maybe just from not listening entirely, so take note. I said two deployments, and then I followed up with, you know, one to Iraq and then one on a boat, and then it just first thing stuck, which is fine. So, but if it were to be a much bigger issue or something, or the main focus of a story, then it could be a big deal.
Yeah.
I did not do two tours to Iraq.
Now the record is
correct. Were there any organizations that actually like reached out to you to fact check or double check things before they published?
Absolutely not. Just
what? Excuse me, but I asked you to
get
married.
Just,
you did.
Oh.
You did
ask me. Are you getting married? Not my girlfriend, no. It's okay, well.
Got called out, I think, on some different, either Fox or CNN, live nationally, saying that we're boyfriend and girlfriend, and they're like, when are you going to get married? And we're like, oh, Jesus.
How about you, Dulce? Anything that was wrong in the coverage?
Not that big. It's actually the opposite that I would say was bad. The little small details, it didn't really have an impact. Not that big. So I didn't feel the need to correct the little small details. But it was more so that, in my mind and for the movement, I have, you know, what's the most pressing issue that needs to come forward on the story, and I have this narrative that I get so excited about that I want to be the primary focus of the story, and then the story would take it like somewhere completely different, or if it's like a live interview or even recorded with camera interview, in-person interview. That someone would speak for me or say it a little bit different, and it's frustrating because it's like, no, in my mind that was the most important part, and you didn't put it there, or you spoke for me, and that took away from the power of the word. So that has been the biggest issue that I've had with stories. And that has come across, whether it's newspaper or TV media or anything really. It's the opposite. It's not so much that the little small details that I have a problem with. It's the overall messaging that I think it's so important for the movement to come out and say, look, us Dreamers, we care more about not increasing border security, because here in San Diego that would mean more agents, especially my parents. And that's the most powerful message that we're struggling so much to get to D.C. and to so that other people become aware of it, including here in San Diego. And then somebody or a reporter would just not mention that, which I think is the most important part of the story, and then we'll just do a very super generic Dreamer story, which to me, it kills me a little bit inside every time that happens.
Did you do anything about that? Follow up or change your strategy for the next interview or anything?
I haven't changed my strategy. Maybe it's something that I'm not emphasizing, but a lot of reporters at the end say, is there something that I'm forgetting that you want us to... And I find that question really makes no difference, because I say, yes, I want to again emphasize that. Our reality here at the border is very different. It still doesn't make it into the piece. And so I'm like, why even ask that question? Like, is there something I'm forgetting when, you know, you're going to put it on there? Because in the first place, if it was important to you, you would have asked me during the interview.
Maybe when the interview is over, just follow up, just conversationally, and say, look, I just want to make it clear. So then you're kind of like beating them over the head. This is the really important point. If you say one thing about this, this is what, I hope you would say. And then you've done your level best to try to get the point across.
Could you make it contractual where they have to agree to mention that? Like,
I could, right?
No. There's no guarantee in PR. Just if you bought an ad, you could.
Yeah.
If
you buy an ad.
You cannot release this piece until I review it.
They would just walk away.
That's a great idea, except that I think I have given over 100 interviews since September. Yeah. So to be tracking every single person. And another pet peeve, I know this is probably off topic for this question, but it's like getting the link to the story sometimes. If I can get business cards, not everybody carries a business card, apparently. and then they always say, you can find it on so-and-so channel, or you can find it on so-and-so webpage. And I'm like, yeah, but it would save me a lot of trouble if you can just email it to me or text it to me. So that's another complaint. Sorry.
It's a good reminder, because I think everyone or a lot of reporters mean to send the link and then forget to send the link. So remember to send the link. All right, Tony,
please.
Let's go.
Things
that are wrong.
Nothing. No. I'm just in my world when I start working with a new client, I spend a decent amount of time, oftentimes. Standing up for all of you, because a lot of folks are scared or they're timid or they know somebody who had a bad experience, and so I spend a decent amount of my initial interaction with a new client saying, you know, most reporters are good people and they're like you and I, and they want to do their job and tell a good story, a fair story, and go home and have dinner with their kids. That's who they are. I used to be one of them. The perception out there, it's not great. So when there are issues with stories, it just feeds that negative perception. So it's a constant thing that you all deal with, and I do. I literally have to warm up some of my clients. Like, go talk to Rory. Rory's okay.
Yeah, well, I'm
going to
ask
you
this first, for some specific stories.
Yeah, so, I thought, overall, I thought the coverage on Chris Kate leaking the memo was fair. I only had one issue there. I just felt like it was sort of the same narrative, just sort of over and over and over. There wasn't much of an attempt to play off the news and figure out, you know, what else is happening with the story. I pitched some angles that didn't really go anywhere. But overall, I thought the coverage on that was fair. The San Diego Unified, I think, has gotten a really unfair coverage from Voice of San Diego. And overall, I'm just really disappointed in the lack of coverage, education coverage in San Diego. Really, other than Voice, nobody really covers education on a regular basis. I know Roy does some education coverage, but yes?
Can you clarify your relationship with San Diego News?
Clark, they're a client.
I wasn't aware of that, so I've always been curious.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're so passionate on this subject.
No, they're a client.
Oh, I thought they had a whole communications team.
They have a couple people.
Yeah,
I help them with strategy and with messaging, and lately we've been working with this grad strategy committee that they formed to look at their graduation rate. And it's a group of educators not affiliated with the district. From community college and charters, and they've been meeting once a month for the past several months, and looking at validating, we did this, right, school district, you need to improve here. So I've been working with that group, and I'm helping them author a report based on all the work that they've done.
So what do you say, Mario, wants to do an interview about the graduation rate? Do you advise them,
I'm not in the day-to-day stuff much. Okay. Maureen handles the day-to-day. There's been a lot of issues with Mario's coverage in particular. You know, he, for a long, long time, said that students were pushed out and unloaded. Those were the words that he used, and he just didn't use them in a story. They were repeated over e-blasts. They were in podcasts. And the suggestion that they made was that they were pushed out and unloaded to boost their graduation rate. And it wasn't true. Kids are counseled all the time. Kids are given options. I want my kids to get options if they're struggling. Look, you can stay in the district. There's some alternative schools that will help struggling students. Or you can stay on the path you're on, but you're struggling here. Or, you can always choose a charter school. It's up to you and your parents. That's called counseling. That's not pushing kids out or unloading them to raise a graduation rate. So that's been frustrating, the coverage there. And then just the lack of education coverage.
So can I just say, to follow up on you, I tried to do that story as well. I did not end up doing it that day. But when I went to the district, I couldn't get anyone to go from the district side to talk to me.
Maureen? Well, not Maureen either?
No, I think I talked to Andrew and Amy and came down with a piece of paper to talk about the
town. Sure.
And I ended up not doing the story because it was too much of a rush. I understood it was more complex than the time I had to do it. But some of the problem was that if we don't, and I hear what you're saying about Voice of San Diego to some extent, but if you don't give Voice of San Diego, you don't help them get both sides of the story or any of these stories.
No, I agree.
You know, that's difficult. And I
no, I agree.
City Unified sort of got there.
I think Maureen's come in and changed the culture. She's still new. I think she
right.
hasn't even been there a year.
I think she has too.
But I think she's really saying what you're saying. Like, we need to get engaged. We need to get involved. Sometimes it'll shake out our way. Sometimes it won't. But we can't stick our head in the sand and act like there's not going to be a story tomorrow.
Well, there's a problem with a story like that, is part of your strategy to engage on Twitter, or is that something you do?
Sometimes, so as you all know, what happens is a story is written, and the story can be fair, objective, and good. But then, oftentimes, the reporter will get on Twitter and start saying things that aren't fair or objective. And so, sometimes we do decide to engage, and a lot of times we decide not to engage. But sometimes we do go on Twitter to set the record straight or attempt to set the record straight.
And then, say in the case of Mario, are there other things you do as well? Do you follow up with him after this?
Absolutely. Yeah, Maureen has most of those conversations. You know, this narrative that they push, though, that the district isn't providing them with a lot of information. You know, Maureen will be the first to tell you that just in the last few months, I think she's handed over 50,000 pages of documents. It's not always when they want it, but they are being more responsive, especially underneath Maureen.
I absolutely agree with you with regard to Maureen. But before Maureen came, it was like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
And so in defense to Voice of San Diego, which
It's a big bureaucracy. It's bigger. It's a bigger bureaucracy than actually City Hall. It's a giant bureaucracy.
Right.
So,
and I want to move on to community choice.
Yes.
Yeah,
sorry.
Well. So, what about community choice government?
So we call community choice aggregation government controlled energy,
okay.
Because that's essentially what it would be. It's really not a choice. If San Diego was to form a community choice aggregator or a government controlled energy program, everyone would be automatically enrolled in the program. So with the coalition that the Clear the Air, the coalition that I'm working with, we've looked at three things. The proponents of government controlled energy say it will create jobs. It will.
No, but we're talking about this. What do you think about this story?
Oh, the coverage.
Yeah.
I think the coverage has been lacking. I think most of the reporters who cover the issue in town have sort of bought the talking points, and to me they've lost their objectivity. They've sort of bought into this idea that it will be cheaper, greener, and better, and the facts are that that isn't supported by what's happened with community choice aggregators throughout California. So that's been frustrating, watching that coverage play out.
Are there specific stories you want to?
Andrew did a story that he looked at the video of the Clear the Air Coalition, and he called me or emailed me. A lot of young reporters don't call, they email, or they text, or they tweet. So I don't know if we talked on the phone or if it was an email, but he had one question about the video. He asked who paid for it. I said Semper Services paid for it. And then that was it. That was the only question he had. And then he wrote this piece that he called a fact check. And his interpretation of the video, parts of his interpretation were fine, but there was a key part of the video that he interpreted. We had a different interpretation of it. And so I said to him, it's fine that you have that interpretation of the video, but here's our interpretation of the video that we produced. Here's what we think it says. And we would like you to include that in your story. And that didn't happen. And so I called Gina, his editor, and I said, hey, you know, I don't mind that he has this interpretation of the video. I'm not asking for a correction, but I would like our interpretation of the video that we produced in the story. And she said, oh, yes, of course. We'll get a paragraph in there saying what you say the video says, and we'll leave the story alone. Otherwise, it's, yeah, that's fine. So.
And they did that?
They did.
Okay. Other things you want to say about that? Or?
No, I don't think so.
I
spoke.
You're sitting right in front of me. Not to put you on the spot.
No, that's all right. I'm not on the panel.
Okay, I want to move on a little bit to Taylor and Bill. Say we both talked with both of you about your personal lives were written about a lot. Did you ever feel exploited, like you opened up and then here it all is in print or on TV?
Not necessarily. Personally, I already knew what storm was coming with the media, and I went through all my social media, cleaned it up, and pulled down pictures I didn't like. That were just, you know, me younger being childish or whatever, and anything that could be portrayed as anything outside of what they were trying to do in their stories. And then, just anything I didn't want shared, I made private.
I'm curious, did someone give you all this advice? Did they, after the shooting, like, because I'm sure it was chaotic, but you seem like someone pulled you aside and said, you can set these boundaries with reporters and that you took the time to clean up. Did that just come from you or did someone guide you?
That was mostly just me knowing how media works, being in media myself. I'm a product designer, but I'm around it every day for stories, and I just see millions and millions of views, clicks, shares, whatever, every day, so I know what comes of it, and just with a little common sense. And being direct, I just told them how it was going to go down or it wasn't going down. And
you were talking about your roommates helped you or something.
Yeah,
right?
So like I said, my roommate worked with Chicago Media up there and just essentially gave her a task list of how to set things up, and she crushed it out and then filtered all my messages and set up appointments and had things going.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because a lot of times we have this panel and someone, you know, was involved in some kind of said, like, you were, and then after that they get, you know, this onslaught of media that they're not prepared for, and so it's...
I think the only time I really got overwhelmed was when I was given the truck. I went down to Arizona to receive the truck, and they said it was going to be local press. When I got there, there was like 15 different news stations and national and everything, and I had, there should be a meme about it. I literally had a necklace of microphones on my shirt, you know, weighing it down. So that was the only time I was overwhelmed a little bit initially walking in, but at that point, they had already had me surrounded. So I was kind of set up, and it kind of sucked for a minute, but I was able to turn a little bit of the story into a positive instead of me just receiving the truck, which I ended up selling, donated some money back to the victims fund, bought out my partner in my business for the machines, and then I made I make products, so I made keychains and sold those and donated 100% profit to the victims fund, and long-term use of that money will just help influence positivity and all that stuff. So it was money well received from a local business that probably could have used some media anyway, so it was a win-win, and I understood that before even accepting the truck. A lot of people just thought I was selfish and trying to take money and, you know, get a free truck for out of a tragedy, but at the end of the day, it took a lot of convincing to go pick it up, first of all, and accept it, and then turn around for a positive, and that was never really shared with the whole whirlwind and virality of getting a free truck. So that was lacking.
What about you, Dulce?
I think for me it's a little bit different because I see my story as a tool again. I am pushing for something, and so my story has become tool for people to actually pay attention, to listen, to some extent feel sorry enough so that they can have a little bit of mercy on us, right? So given that, I have worked really hard with every single interview to just let my guard down. Growing up, you know, I lived a very sheltered life and in the shadows for over 25 years. I feel like, and I've said this before, I didn't have a voice until DACA. Once I received DACA, and especially when I became a lawyer, I felt like I had a voice. For the first time, I could say things like, I'm undocumented, without trembling. So my story, I feel, being used in the movement, I feel a bit of responsibility to let the guard down and speak out. So when I'm getting interviewed, I find myself telling pieces of my story more and more and more. And sometimes I don't realize when I'm being exploited until someone next to me tells me and says, you know, something like, you know, I'm a journalist and I don't agree with what so-and-so just did because you shouldn't be exploited that way. And that happened to me this last December, and I didn't really realize what was happening because in my mind, I tell myself, this is for the movement, this is for a good cause, this is for the right cause, and so I speak from my heart, so that hopefully those listening can also relate to me. And so someone opened my eyes to that, and that's why when I was contacted to participate in this panel, that was like on my mind, because I didn't even realize that this was happening to me. And a journalist said, you know what, there's a line between exploiting a story and reporting, and I don't agree with what so-and-so just said, because we don't need you to be on tears to be reporting it, right? And I remember, recently I gave a story to someone out, I think it was a Japanese reporter in town, and I felt really comfortable with her. And I started talking to her about, you know, how a lot of immigrants go through sexual abuse and don't report it because we're undocumented, so we keep it to ourselves. And I started to tell her, all of a sudden I heard myself as I'm telling this, telling her about what happened to me then, and that was something new that I'd never told anyone. And so I had this, she was so comfortable to talk to that I started to tell that piece that I had said before. then I see the camera person, and I could hear my voice breaking. I probably was already a tear or two in it. And then I see the camera person move in and close in, and that's when I was like back with my wall up. I'm like, something triggered that said, you know, you're vulnerable and watch what you're saying right now. But I'm working on it because I feel like what I say every time I get on camera, it's with a purpose, and it's not for me. It's bigger than me. I agreed to be a named plaintiff on the lawsuit because there's 800,000 DACA recipients right now suffering from the uncertainty of being in limbo. And we go to D.C. and lobby, and we're doing all kinds of actions because there's 11 million of us here undocumented that we're fighting for. So I keep telling myself that right before an interview, and sometimes even during it. And so that's the question that sometimes I don't even know if I'm being exploited or not until someone else points it out and says, you know, what just happened is not right.
Did they end up using that, what you were saying?
I haven't seen that. I didn't get the link. Oh. And they're from Japan, so I don't know how to track them down. I don't know if it's because there is a camera on. And I haven't felt like that with a newspaper reporter, so maybe that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the difference between Spanish-speaking media and English-speaking media. Taff, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so even getting a story covered is sometimes challenging to get the English media to come on board and report on an action that we're doing. And whereas the Spanish-speaking media, they're, you know, on top of it immediately, right? And I know why, you know, because especially with TV, you know, it seems like Univision and Telemundo, they have like a designated immigration area on their website, on their Facebook, on their social media, right? And so locally, when we have an action, they show up. Don't question it. Univision and Telemundo is going to be there. But then the rest of the folks, I don't know what happens. I had a gentleman come into my office from Channel 10 this week who said, I didn't even know you were in town, that you were one of the named plaintiffs, and I didn't even know there was this lawsuit. And I'm like, where have you been the last 6 months? because if people are flying in from Belgium, from Saudi Arabia to interview me, from North Korea, I'm sorry, South Korea, from New Mexico, flying in for this interview, and you're here in town, why is it that 90% of the English-speaking media is not covering this? So that has been a huge difference, just trying to get the attention of the English-speaking media has been a challenge for us. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, our community, a lot of us cannot vote, so we're trying to get our stories to the people that can make this difference and change, especially on the 49th and 50th district, right? But if the media there is not reporting it, that has been a challenge for us.
That relates to my last question, then I'm going to open it up to more audience questions. Well, I guess then we'll grade. We'll do last question, then we'll grade, then audience questions. What stories have been missed this year? So you're talking about the overall story of DACA recipients that you feel like has been missed? Or
The border reality, because seems like, and we tell each other this, and I have a couple of junior folks in the audience, we tell each other, you know, we're popular, right? We're there on a national level. We're out there. We're an issue. But the border reality keeps getting lost. And so when people report on our stories, on our actions, they go, you know, Dreamers block Dianne Feinstein's, or streets to Dianne Feinstein's office, or Dreamers march to the wall, or Dreamers do a vigil, but they don't really report on our message, on what is it that we want to get out there. And I understand it's not paid advertising, someone mentioned here. I understand we can't you know, write the stories for them or report on them, but if they could listen a little bit better to actually say the Dreamers are doing it because of this, because they want their voter reality exposed. They march to the wall because they're not okay with the wall being built, because they don't want more agents. As opposed to just Dreamer spoke at Campa's campaign thing, and then what we have worked so hard to get the message out, you know, that gets lost. So that's my frustration.
Tony's stories you feel like have been missed?
More topics, I would say. Like, I'd like to see more coverage of the housing crisis. I don't even think it's a crisis anymore. There was a senator in Sacramento who said it's an emergency. It's not a crisis. You know, Lisa Halverson and some others did a wonderful job with the homelessness story and really brought that into the mainstream. And I really would love to see that with the housing crisis, the housing emergency. And there's so many stories to tell. I mean, people are moving out. Seniors, none of our graduates are staying. You know, businesses are suffering. So there's great profiles, really rich stories, I think, that aren't being told to help convince, you know, lawmakers that this is an emergency and here's how it's impacting all of us. You know, there's no basements in San Diego. I'm from Detroit. We had basements. You could graduate from high school and college and live in your parents' basement until you're 30. You can't do that, you know, unless there's a granite flat, you know. So I think that's an issue I'd like to see the coverage elevated. I think I would like to see more coverage of schools. San Diego Unified is a client. There's a lot of wonderful stories there. I mean, 70% of their students are minority students, and the district is doing wonderful things. The kids in that district speak over 100 different languages. Again, there's just so many rich stories. I mean, they have more employees than Qualcomm, but not a lot of media coverage. And then I think locally, the media could do a better job of covering the media. You know, we would do well to have a media column in the Union Tribune, I think, once a week, where the media is checking the media. You know, Matt Hall did and Steve Breen went to La Jolla High School recently after the students who they clearly missed the mark. They were trying to play off a racist ad. They were trying to satire.
That's right. Cartoon, right?
Yeah. It was meant to be satirical, and they just missed the mark. And City View really railed on them. And Matt said, you know, here, this column is flawed, and here's why it's flawed. And I met with these students. And I think we would do well to have more of that. I don't know how many of you know this, but you know, Voice of San Diego's founder is a huge charter school advocate, and Thrive is one of his pet projects. And the Voice writes about Thrive and doesn't disclose that their founder is affiliated with Thrive and is a big advocate for Thrive financially and charter schools. If you look,
I
brought a prop. This here lists, they do a little story here, the five most innovative schools in the county. Thrive is listed as one of the five. There's no mention here that their founder, who continues to be the largest financial contributor, is also invested in Thrive. And so I think a media columnist, you know, somebody like Jerry Braun back in the day who knew how to turn a phrase. I think we're missing that. I did not. But if you do a quick Google search, just Voice of San Diego and Thrive, so on the first Google page, there's three stories that all have really nice things to say about Thrive, and only one of them mentions at the bottom of the column that their founder is also a major supporter of Thrive. Now, when they asked me to write an op-ed about Chris Cade, and I put my disclaimer at the bottom. I put Chris is a client. I put that at the bottom. And they moved that. They kept it at the bottom. They copied and pasted it and put it in the second paragraph. And I liked that second paragraph. I had turned a phrase. I was really fond of that paragraph. And they messed it up, but I didn't push back. I said, you know, whatever.
It's never right.
But I didn't tell Kinsey or Sarah, you know, can we move that down? Or I just said, you know, okay, whatever. But why is that rule applied to me, but not to them? I mean, if I have to disclose in the second paragraph, shouldn't they? So,
So it would be a column in the UT that would like critique
the media coverage for the past week. Yeah, let's look back at, you know, what was good, what was bad, what missed the mark. I think it would serve a fill in the year. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it would have to, right? In order to, yeah. So I don't know how you would do that.
It would be good nationally as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. David Carr was a wonderful, media critic. He's no longer with us. He was with the New York Times. I don't think we'll ever see another David Carr. But I think there needs to be more nationally of the media checking the media, especially now. I mean, what's going on nationally? The media is under constant fire. So it'd be great to have a column, and maybe there is one, but I certainly doesn't come to mind right now. So.
What about you, Taylor? We talked about, after a shooting, then there's a lack of coverage of the impacts on people who survived it.
Essentially, without anyone specifically, the question is what coverage after the fact has been little to zero after 2 weeks out from it, 5 months away. That was the 2 weeks that the event, the largest mass shooting in modern American history, that went down, and there was 2 weeks covered. And there's been no strong follow-up, no pursuit of accountability, no pursuit of what's actually going on. There's just nothing.
But to what extent do you think that, like, they're going back to Newtown, or they're going back to Aurora? I mean, like, how many of these shootings, I wonder, like, I feel like from a journalist perspective, we have to keep our audience's capacity for outrage and capacity for compassion in mind when we cover these kinds of stories, and so I think people are already fatigued about the coverage of all the shootings that are happening in America.
I can see that on someone who wasn't involved in one of the mass shootings. And if you were not involved and you were even a city away, you may not even, be touched or feel compassionate. It doesn't affect you. We all have our own lives day to day. For the people involved, you feel left in the dark, like everyone has forgot about you, and the media has moved on to the next rating. And it's just been an interesting concept to see the lack, especially just around anyone for whatever reason. But I didn't see any other shootings. Much longer periods of time that's on national television and then talked about locally and around anyone specifically was not entirely, but for the most part, shut down after 2 weeks. And it's very interesting, whatever reasons may be, but every other shootings went much longer and had follow-up conversations. And for us, we've started a community of trauma therapy. And we were lucky to have one of the highest qualified trauma therapists in my opinion, the world. She has multiple doctorate degrees, spends 2,000 to 5,000 hours a month with veterans and active military, and when an average therapist is 600 to 1,000 hours a month of therapy sessions. And she was also there around 91 with me. Everyone around her got killed, so she knows firsthand the trauma ensued from that, and also has the capability and tools to help expand that. And we've started a group in San Diego, and we've went to Vegas, and I'm about to go to Parkland, and we're talking with the mayor and principal, and we're going to give the tools that we've learned here in San Diego via Shiva on how to just educate yourself on trauma, what to expect, and how to use it as a tool to move forward with your community. And that's definitely not covered in really any of the shootings, is the mental health of the community afterwards. And essentially the whole nation is kind of desensitized to what mental trauma people go through after a tragic event, such as Route 91. And I can't find anything online to address that. So we bought trauma411.org, and we're working with the Red Cross, and we're going to essentially make mental health cool again. Not going to use that slogan because it's not neutral. But that's, long story short, there's a lot of desensitization in America that no one's really addressing, and it's making stronger influences in communities and teaching about trauma and or just mental health education. It's quite lacking.
What's it been like for you to watch the coverage of the Parkland shooting and to see all of the victims really push themselves out in the media like you did in a way, but be make a completely different decision to make it political and make it about gun control, whereas you felt like you didn't want to touch that and you wanted to be about the positive, you know, the story of people helping other people in times of crisis?
Well, in a compassionate version of me, it's good for them to have something to pursue, and they don't know what they're going through, essentially. I've got, you know, combat trauma prior, and going into the whole round 91, I was more well-prepared than most people, essentially, more so than high schoolers. So they're not dealing with it in any capacity that I would, and a direct form of that is anger, and when something like that happens, you feel helpless, and the only way to help balance that is to feel like you're doing something. And so gun control, and it's great, like 100% agree, there needs to be some level of gun control, and there's some things that don't need to be out there that are, and they're doing an amazing thing, and they're going to continue to get coverage for months, potentially years, we'll see, but it's because it's political and it's given that community to cling on to something. But why we've been talking to the mayor and principal, and we're going to go there with no media. We're not going to tell anyone our dates. We're just going to go there covert and address the whole community on mental health and trauma education. And when the dust settles, and it will, the media will have a lax, and it's going to impact the community severely. Like, they're going to feel it tenfold, and they're not going to know what to do. They're not going to know how to handle themselves. And then, you know, if we want to keep them strong and keep whatever gun movement they want to pursue going, they need to be mentally prepared, and that's not going to happen without proper mental health care.
So you're saying when the media pulls out, their spirits are going to collapse?
It's already happened. I've gotten it's a big community. I mean, we had 22,000 people at Route 91, and my girlfriend is from Florida. Her mom works in a real estate business right next to the school, and she knows everyone there, and they've reached out to me, and they've all said that they went to school, and, you know, the first couple hours, everyone just started breaking down, and, you know, it's not the strong little high schoolers you saw on TV talking to politicians anymore. It's people scared and nothing to do. Like, they're just defenseless and helpless, and the images and scenes and everything they've been through are going to affect them for a very, very long time.
Did it ever cross your mind to make your message political, or was that never an option for you?
It wasn't an option. I already knew what the media would try to do to it immediately, and that was the first thing I even said to them before agreeing to any interview was, this will not be political, it will not be religious. I'm not going to give you my opinion on what I think happened, if there was one shooter, multiple shooters, government conspiracy, whatever have you. So it's going to be about a positive message and what the community can do together, and just essentially tell my story how it was, and that's it. And that's what everyone stuck to, and I appreciated all the reporters that didn't try to pry into rating questions, essentially. That's what they are. And it's very well done when they respect me.
So how would you grade the media coverage?
A-minus. Very good, but could have delved a little deeper into some of their research. But everything was happening so fast, and there's a lot going on, so I can see how some things can be overlooked, and you just got to move on to the next story when, you know, there's 22,000 potential people to interview.
What about you?
I'm
going to
split mine to Spanish and English. So Spanish get a B+. Because they have reported on me as a person and not just the dreamer as the issue. And I felt like when they were doing the profile pieces, they were actually truly getting to know It's not an A because I hate the B-roll part. You know, you have to pretend you're on the keyboard actually working. They had me get off my car, which was super dirty that day, and open the door. For that reason, it's not an A, just for that. Other than that, they show up, and I feel like they're the ones that really elevate our voices and truly hear what we have to say. And English gets a C just because we have to be there in order to report. And I feel like sometimes I have to do something that is outrageous or big. Or I always get asked by the English ones, not the Spanish ones, how many people do you expect to show up? It's like, does it really matter? Does it really matter whether we have 100 people or 5 people? And it happens all the time. And, you know, at times I've expected 100 people and then 10 show up. And we did an art show and I thought we were going to get 50 people. And I was like, if we get 50 people, we're good. And we got 500 people. So I never have an accurate answer. But I feel like it's exhausting when, just telling the story is exhausting emotionally because it's something that is so hurtful to us, to the idea that I've been here 30 years and now I have to fight to be here. Or I've seen my brother in detention for months and just telling it hurts. And then having to act on it to make it a political movement, that is exhausting. And mentally it's draining. And then to make an action that is worthwhile for the media to show up to, that just adds, you know, salt to injury. So you guys get to see.
Can I just say that NBC is Telemundo? So
yeah, I've been to the studio.
But if we send Telemundo, they will also be the
one. Yeah, there was I forget his name, I'm sorry, but just I met recently. And then he called Lisette and he's like, hey, I'm here at Luz's office. Do you want the story? And then you guys communicate that way. But I haven't given an interview to NBC7 in English. They've all been in Spanish.
They don't ask you for an interview in English?
No. Huh. Lisette from Telemundo has taken one or two sentences that I say in English just so she can say she covered the story, right? But no one in English has come to my office to make a piece about me or a story or an action unless it's an international person coming in. But yeah, I've been to the studio where it's funny because I'm like, man, if I could only walk 3 steps over so they can cover me there too, that would be great. But no, I've given live interviews on the Telemundo and the Univision side, not yet 5 steps from there. And QSI had me there for like a minute, but you can't really tell everything in such a short time span. So yeah, the Dreamer story is out there. We're popular, but our message gets lost. Still a C.
Yeah, but we're all in a meeting together, so we talk about who's going to get English, who's going to get Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So we're assuming they're getting English if they're talking to you. But if that's not happening, then we need to find out what. Of course, they are assuming that I'm getting Spanish sometimes and I forget. So sometimes we're just not as we don't have as much follow through as we should have.
Yeah, so Lisette from Telemundo, like I said, she would say one or two things in English, right, to cover a story. But she has done, like, profile pictures of the actions that we've done, like an actual pre-action interview, right? And she gets the details, really detailed, but they've always been in Spanish, not a single one in English.
Tony?
The 3 topics I was asked to discuss tonight, I would give the Voice a C- for their coverage of San Diego Unified. I would give the Energy Reporters, sorry, Andrew, you're one of them, a C for their coverage. And I would give the reporters who covered the Memo Gate, I would give them a B. And overall, I would give the local media a B+. And you would get an A-. Except for the tweeting, that drags you down. And, you know, everybody wants to, all these reporters in town want to tweet like, you know, Matt Hall and Scott Lewis, but they forget that Matt Hall and Scott Lewis are paid for their opinions. And, you know, you don't probably understand how often your tweets are emailed around more often than your stories. And did you see who's in the tank? And I'm getting a tweet from a client that a reporter, you know, I'm not getting the story. So just be mindful.
People are watching.
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time. So.
All right. Audience, Omar,
Yeah, my question actually kind of follows Dulcet, but it might be a question that any of you can answer. That notion of like the media needing you to create, almost manufacture news for them to bother to show up. It's like why we get like, Carnival Barkers running for office and the Trumps of the world. I wonder, honestly, maybe less of you, Taylor, since your story was one. You were the one in demand, right? That story was in demand. But in the other scenarios...
Not anymore, though, so I can still...
Oh, well, then maybe
hold side of the coin for you.
So I guess that's the question, right? It's like, how to handle, how do you compensate for the push of journalists, typically, and this broad brushstroke, but to wait until there's some sort of sensational version of the news as opposed to the news?
I don't think...
Yeah, I understand it. I was wondering why I go first.
Okay.
I'd say at the beginning it was understood from the beginning as a story that they wanted and or needed because it's going to be extremely high ratings and that generates profit. And not saying any of you, but at the higher level, it's what it comes down to. Most likely not going to do extensive coverage on something that's not going to get good ratings because then
Do you agree with the lady at the NRA who says the media loves these mass shootings?
No.
It's disgusting.
I know, but you were just saying that media eats up the ratings, which is what she was trying to get across.
Essentially. I mean,
Dana Loesch, whatever.
It's science. Humans are programmed to react to negativity and survival, and when it's posted across social media and where the news will react to it more, and higher ratings, but we tried to, with my story, keep the positivity, and it still did great, so counteracted what I thought initially, so it goes both ways, but for your question directly, after the fact, I've learned how to manipulate the media, and manipulation is not a bad word, it's utilizing tools you know how to use in a way to gain favor in the direction you want to go, and it could be for a negative reason or a positive reason. I want to spread mental health, so I manipulate the media when I can to do a story on me or fly me out and get me to a community or something like that. And once you understand more so how the media works, you can use that to your advantage and let them use you to use them.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
While you were talking earlier, Tom, and I could see there was a second one. I said, that's a good story. Have we done that? We'll follow up. But see, if we don't know about it, we can't cover it. So if you ever sent out a news release, if you call, I know your friend Tom, if you call Tom and say, hey, we're going to go to Florida with a group, mental health, have you ever done that? Because we don't know.
Not yet. I'm not complaining about that because
I
don't want coverage yet.
More,
and that's where it comes into my manipulation of utilizing the situation is when I want to reach out, I will.
So you haven't wanted to yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
But we could talk. I would only want to do it. So my
you already have.
Well, why? You don't know when, though, so you don't know when.
Yeah,
when
I know, but heads up. Yeah, I know.
For me, it sounds like you're saying, that the coverage stopped and so forth. And I hear that.
Yeah.
However, there's a flip side to that maybe we don't know what you're doing, so we didn't cover what we're doing.
Well,
I know
when
that
I say
I on
coverage has stopped, I'm talking about essentially what the fuck happened in Vegas. What happened? No one knows. There's so many conflicting things and so little information being released, and it's pretty crazy that it just pretty much stopped after 2 weeks. I don't really care at this point because my mission is trying to help those that have been affected and also other mass casualties. So I'm not really focused on Vegas anymore. I'm focused on the survivors, and they're from all over the world. I got Canadian groups. I got groups down in Mexico. I went to Crash My Playa and had a meeting there with a bunch of people. They've just flown in from Germany, Berlin, Switzerland, and there's people that were affected all over the world that, you know, need some kind of trauma mental health, and that's just kind of where we were at. But
did you guys have thoughts on Omar's question as well?
Well, I personally believe the media has played, it's like an ally to us. It's played a huge role in our movement. Without coverage, you know, we die, our movement dies. I have heard dreamers tell me, like, you know, throughout the last 6 months, you know, no one's talking about us now. No one's talking about us now. And there have been those periods when, unless something big is happening, then, you know, there's no coverage. And so there's this need that we have to create an action so that we can keep being in the news, so that we can have something to report on. Otherwise, dreamer stories are not going to be out there, right? I mean, there's 40,000 DACA recipients here. I'm sure you guys can find someone to report on. But it is a little bit exhausting to think that we have to keep outdoing ourselves locally at the very least. You know, if we're blocking, we're doing civil disobedience one day, blocking ourselves, the next thing has to be bigger, better, brighter, and shinier for you guys. And that has been a challenge for us. But we definitely want to be in people's minds, you know, as much as we can, especially on an election year, and push our narrative out there. So I'm very grateful that we're even getting any coverage, you know, and I think accurate reporting is essential for a movement or we die. It goes nowhere. So I'm very appreciative of media, but there is the sense that we have to somehow create action, create something that will be worthwhile to the media to report on, because sometimes our own personal stories is not enough.
Matt Hall with the Tribune. Speaking of creating something, the Tribune created a forum for border issues and immigration. You were one of the panelists on that. We Facebook Live did, a lot of hundreds of people showed up. Afterward, got some criticism from some people who said we gave some platforms to people who shouldn't be given platforms. I was curious to see what you think of that, what you think of the controversy, and your seat on it.
Yeah, so that panel was in this, I wasn't so close to the audience. So it was at USD, and so there was a distance between the audience and me. And the person that was next to me, I think his name is Bob, he's a rancher. I think they were
a lot nicer than Bob, right?
Very much so. I don't think you're a racist, and I very much think Bob is. I really do.
For a long time.
Yeah, you know, the Minuteman type, and he's very proud of it, and here I am undocumented sitting next to him. So that itself is a controversial image, right? And he brought his family, and I brought my family, and I didn't hear what was going on in the audience, because I'm hard of hearing anyways to start with, and there was a distance there, and I was more focused on answering the questions somewhat accurately and not making a fool of myself, and this is before the DACA rescission and before the lawsuit, so I had zero experience even interviews or doing anything like that, especially telling my story. That was the first time out loud, and here I am telling it with a Minuteman type rancher next to me who was saying things like, yeah, I would shoot him dead if I see them crossing by my land, and here I am thinking, oh, you could have shot my uncle when he was attempting to cross the desert, you know? So from that perspective, from where I was sitting, I didn't have an issue with, at that moment, with the people that were invited, because I think it's super important that we have dialogue, whether it's someone that is totally the opposite spectrum on immigration and me being undocumented. So I think the dialogue is super important. But later I heard that Bob's family was saying super racist comments and making my family and the rest of the people uncomfortable, and I was not aware of it. But I can't attest to what was being said, because I didn't hear anything. If I go just by the people that were invited on the panel, I think it's important to have dialogue. But as a mediator, whoever is controlling the conversation at that moment must clarify statements made at that time, whether you're doing follow-up questions or something like that. or even sometimes when it gets, people are, I have grown a thick skin, but if I hear some things like, yeah, I would shoot him dead or something like that, then it makes me feel a little uncomfortable to hear that. And so I'm more worried about what I'm going to say, what I'm going to do, and if someone could step in and intervene at that moment. Obviously, you know, that's very much appreciated. I don't feel attacked right now, so thank you, Tony. So you have to be wary of who it is that's in your panel, because if I was maybe a little bit younger and not a lawyer, or, you know, maybe more traumatized or something like that, that person couldn't have handled it the way that I did. Yeah.
I'm talking a lot, but I'm wondering, Dulce, if you could talk about what I'll call respectability politics. Like, I think the media, well, so, you know, in your advocacy and in this movement, it seems to be really trying to elevate the golden undocumented immigrant who has, you know, straight A's and everything, and creating this narrative that, you know, all these people are excellent, they're, you know, they're wonderful people with no faults, let's say. And does that do a disservice to maybe undocumented immigrants who might have a DUI, and so we have no sympathy for them because, you know, like they messed up and they should be deported, or you know, other I mean, and you know, are there times when maybe that narrative starts to crumble with an individual, and all of a sudden you realize we like chose this person to be our spokesperson, and then, you know, some reporter dug up some, you know, like stupid thing that they might have done in their past, and now all of this comes crashing down and everyone starts attacking them.
Yeah, so you just hit the mark on our talking points as far as our movement goes. This image of the perfect immigrant, we're trying to you know, elevate our parents more than anything, and that's the frustration that I have, that there's the generic story of the dreamer, right? The perfect immigrant. And that's what we don't want here, especially our group, San Diego Board of Dreamers. We're always trying to elevate our parents. And we have no doubt that we'll get some sort of permanent resolution for dreamers. That we know. The majority of Americans want us here. That's not what we're fighting for. We're fighting for our communities because we don't want the wall, because we don't want more agents in our community. They're not going to be questioning my friends and I. They're going to be questioning my parents. And so I am very appreciative for my parents' sacrifices, because I wouldn't be a lawyer in Mexico where I'm from. And so I'm very thankful for everything that this country has offered. But I'm also very thankful for my mom's sacrifices, and I don't think that she should be punished in any way for her decision, the right decision to bring me across the border, because I am the example and the reason, you know, walking example of what could happen if you come to America, right? You can achieve your dream. So that is exactly why we are fighting to get to D.C. and fight this narrative of the perfect immigrant, and that only dreamers should be protected and the rest of the community should be screwed. And that's why we keep doing the actions, and that's why we keep pushing for a clean Dream Act, and we're doing everything from walking to a parade to blocking streets, everything so that we deviate from that narrative that is on a national wide scale. And that's why we're relying on the local media, especially District 49 and 50th, to help people understand that this is not just about the 800,000 DACA recipients. This is about our parents. This is about our communities. And that's the message that tends to be left out, that is the reason for my low grade to you guys.
Hey, Omar, don't leave. I wanted to mention something. Sorry. No, we're running for office.
We'll do like two more questions after this anyway, so that's okay.
You talked about sitting on news until you have this like event, right? In most cases when you push news out, you do want a new peg. You want there to be tied to a development or a ruling, a decision, a new wrinkle in the case. But you don't always need a news peg. You can play off the news. Hey, I haven't thought about doing this. I know you covered this angle, but I haven't thought about this angle. And also what we tell folks is you can't just rely on the media. You have to go direct. You have to use social media. You have to
consider podcasts, consider, you know, a blog.
Look at my website, no.
Yeah, you got to go direct, you know.
Omar
so,
social media.
Yeah, for sure.
50-minute podcast.
For sure. Now, you know, it's great when you have this great event that brings all the sticks in town, but that doesn't happen too often, so it has to be more of a holistic approach.
Let's go, Lindsay, Michael, and then we'll be good.
So, my name is Lindsay, I'm a reporter with Union Tribune, and I wrote a version of Taylor's story. But something that you said kind of, I think, resonated with me about the fall off, the kind of the cliff of coverage, especially in breaking news. And so I cover breaking news every day. And one of the things that I find really hard to kind of communicate with readers, not just people who I'm writing about, but also people who are reading that coverage, is that, you know, the pace of news, when it's breaking, there's lots of new information. You know, we're constantly, like, gathering all of these new threads. And so for 2 weeks, there's lots of new. And after 2 weeks, there's a lot less new. There's, you know, investigations are slow, they're complicated, you have these kind of smaller pieces that you kind of put together, but at least I recognize or I notice in my, like, kind of long-term coverage that even if I'm following those secondary stories, the people who are reading or consuming that information is, like, a very steady decline. That you can spend a lot of time and energy on these stories, even those kind of little follow-ups, but it's just not getting the resonance. And so I guess what I was kind of curious about, and this is really a question for all of you, if, you know, how do you feel the media can do a better job at infusing those stories with energy? Because it's never going to have the energy of a breaking shooting, but can we do a better job at getting people interested in that topic? Do we need to do a better job at kind of fueling ongoing conversation? Because I just feel like after 2 weeks, I'm writing and people aren't caring. So,
well, that's your answer right there. People lose interest too fast. So that's not the media's fault, essentially. But there's strong investigative things that media could do if you're talking about Rutland one specifically. I've done better investigative journalism than 90% of the media, and I know more facts with basic Google searches than the media is portrayed, and or lack thereof.
Maybe in terms of the hotels.
Just anything you've heard on the news times 10. There's just so much more, and nothing has been covered or probably will be covered because it's not going to resonate, like you said, with populace. Half of America thinks I'm an actor, and it didn't happen. I've had people personally try to assault me, send me letters, emails. When I was in Crash My Playa in Mexico, a lady at the pool I was talking to was there, and her child has gotten beat up at school because the parents are talking about it at home that the whole thing was fake and some government conspiracy, and the kids heard that and then they took that to school and bullied the kids that were there. So compounded on the trauma they're already going through from almost dying, and they're getting beat up at school for it. And that's just one of the many cases. Another lady in Vegas was approached in a parking structure, and I'm just part of a lot of groups, so I know all the insides. And some massive man saw a Route 91 sticker on her car and told her, "You should be ashamed of yourself in our city for trying to push that propaganda and government fake story and all this stuff," and like got aggressive with her, and she had to run away. And there's thousands of stories like that. There's millions of people that think it was fake.
I would spend more time game planning. There's a lot of smart people over in that building, and you guys are reacting. We do it too, right? We react 80% of the time and carve out hopefully 20% of the time to be proactive. But our best work oftentimes is the proactive work because we give it a lot of thought. And we hear from a lot of different voices in the office, and it's just richer, it's fuller, it's better. What are we missing? You know?
And we push those meetings off. You know, we work on a big project and we're on deadline.
So it's just push off the brainstorming session that's on the calendar for every Tuesday at 10 a.m. have those meetings, and eventually they'll bear fruit.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, Tony, you mentioned at multiple times, I think, about the cleaner facility.
Yeah.
About that particular, in general, the coverage had bought certain talking points, of, and you felt that those were wrong, and listed some of your own talking points. And so I don't cover that story. I don't know, the truth of it, but someone had agreed with you, you would probably say, oh, look, they got the truth, not they bought into my talking point. So I guess my question for everyone is just how do you, when you're reading coverage about yourself or about an issue that you're involved with, how do you sort of sort out what could be, like, legitimate disagreements? I'm not narcissistic enough to think that everything I think is, everyone should agree with it, and what is sort of legitimate, people are getting stuff, like, factually wrong, or have a spin on it. How do you discern what is agree to disagree and what is actionable?
As in responding to a story that's already been put out and deciphering it as what's opinion and what's fact?
Not about opinion or fact, but like if you read coverage and I'm sure in most stories you're not the only person quoted. And I don't know how much coverage of your story has necessarily been critical of you. So maybe this is more for Dulce and Tony, but
so on that,
I'm sure that legitimate news organizations haven't been calling into question your story. So maybe this isn't for you
to like follow up with it.
Yeah.
Not really, unless I were to do something and go out of my way to get attention, then they would follow up. I've even met with some of the guys from Fox and bumped into a few guys from CNN at the airport and told them potentially we're doing some kind of movement, and they're like, cool, you know. So I would have to go out of my way, this gentleman in the back had said, to get attention and make it some kind of story, and just knowing the media, I know how I could, and that's what it would take, honestly, to get the next story or follow up.
On the energy stuff,
yeah.
I've let most of it go. And the only direct challenge I had with any of the coverage was the fact that it didn't include our perspective of what we're saying. We have internal discussions where we're frustrated, and how do we deal with this narrative that we don't agree with? Well, we need to do a better job of getting our points across. So oftentimes it's those type of discussions we're having instead of, we got to work with you on a lot of different stories for a lot of years. I'm not going to jump on your case every time you write something I don't agree with.
Aside from Breiberg, I haven't had that issue. I declined an interview with Carlson Tucker, and then other than that, the opposition hasn't really reached out to me. So everybody else that has covered it, I haven't had issues that are like that, where they take a long story. First, he apologized for not being here. What else? When we asked him certain stories he thought were unfair, he said not unfair, but UT editorial after
the short-term vacation rental debate
was not exactly on point or captured my version. He said Lisa's piece on Hep A was instrumental to the conversation of Hep A, as I think Claire's on housing vouchers will be this year.
I replied to what the editorial, all right?
Okay. So, what's our SPJ, CTM?
Yeah.
Read the post-game analysis. I think that's it. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
You guys have an extremely important job, and it's an incredible resource, and people out in the middle of nowhere, you're the only thing they see, you're the only facts they see, so it's extremely important that you guys do your research and try to do the best you can, because you're the only source that millions of Americans have, even in our city, so.
That's much better than that.